Hello and welcome to Into the Foliage, hosted by me, Ryan Dalton.
And me, Janet Garner. The series all about the green side of nature.
Where we chat to the professionals about plants, trees, fungi, grasses.
And everything in between.
Hi, Jan. Welcome. Hello. Well, why am I welcoming you to the show? You're the co-host.
I know. Because you're used to doing it on your own. That's why, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I was hosting Ryan going, Jan, welcome to the show. It's lovely to see you. How has your day been, mate?
Yeah, good. Work, as usual. Work. No lockdown for me.
No. You're a key worker, you.
Yeah, I'm a key worker. Yeah. Stapling stuff to walls and that.
The listeners have no idea what you do, so you sound crazy right now. She works in a school, guys. Yeah. Stapling pupils to the walls.
Yeah.
What have you been doing? What gardening thing have you done this week, Jan?
Right, Ryan, I've got exciting news on the gardening front because my sweet peas have germinated.
Get in!
I know, right? See, that they're on the windowsill and one
You're so happy, look at your face!
I really am. One came up and I thought, oh, you know, planted about 20, but they've started popping up. Beyond excited, I can't tell you.
I am so happy for you because this has been a real journey over lockdown.
It really has. The problem I've got is I don't know what to actually do with them now. I'll have to go back to Google or whatever. But so seeds now I'm into. So what about you this week? What have you got?
I have repotted 3 cacti.
Oh,
very, very nervous time because I find cacti, once you mess with them, they go.
Risky.
They like absolutely, they're like an emo child. Just ignore them and they're fine. But any attention and they go off on one. So I'm watching them closely, but they seem to be all right. It's been a few days, but I'll watch them closely. There's 3. One of them I found on the street. Someone just left the cactus out.
Really?
As if it was like, you know, go off into the world on your own, little cactus. And it has. It's now got a new home.
So you've adopted it.
I've adopted my new little rescue cactus. So, yeah, that's my gardening thing. This is our first episode with a guest. Are you excited?
I'm really excited, actually. Really.
That's good. If you'd said no, it would have been horrifically
rude. Yeah, it would have been rubbish, wouldn't it?
Shall we bring our guest in? Let's introduce him now. I'm very much looking forward to talking to him. Our guest today is an expert on all things UK wild plants. He's nodding his head as if he's unsure about that now. He's currently finishing Orchid Genetics PhD at Kew Gardens and a 2-time author of the books Winter Trees and then another book called The Orchid Hunter. It is Leif Bersweden. Hello, Leif. How are you?
Hi, Ryan. Hi, Jan. I'm very well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm genuinely so honoured to have been asked to do this. So, yeah, I'm really excited.
Well, that means a lot to us, I think, that you feel honoured. But it's a pleasure to meet you and talk to you. We both are fans of you online as well. You put up some incredible plant content.
Oh, thank you.
Which is so nice to see. let's get to the basics. Do you want to tell everyone who's listening right now who you are and what is it you do?
Yes. So, yeah, my name's Leif. I'm a botanist, as you've probably guessed by now. And I basically spend my entire life trying to persuade people that plants are awesome. And yeah, I guess like they're just as worthy of our attention as animals are. And yeah, I'm also doing this PhD, which I probably should have led with. So I hope my supervisor isn't listening to this. But yeah, I'm doing this orchid PhD, where I'm studying hybridization between different species of orchid who have petals that look like little people. So they've got arms and legs. So they're quite cool. But yeah, as you say, I'm nearly finished. I'm so excited to finish. But yeah, this is quite a nice distraction. It's been 4 years. Started it 4 years ago. And I'm a couple of months away from finishing. So yeah, I'm very, very excited.
Exciting times.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit stressful, but otherwise good.
So what will you do when it's finished? What are your plans?
So I'm actually not allowed to tell you. Oh. Which I realise it's such a pants
Sorry,
answer
no comment.
For the first question on the podcast. Yeah, I'm not allowed to tell you. I'm really sorry.
Also, Jan, you asked that like you're his mum.
Oh, no, well, you know, I am a mum, so... What are you going to do with this life?
Yeah, like, all well and good, but what are you going to do with it?
Yeah, so yeah, I do apologise. That's a terrible first answer to a question on a podcast, but there you go.
That's all right, Jan, move on to the next question.
You can just cut that one out, you know.
So when oh, let's get to one that you can answer then. Right, so when did your love of plants begin?
My love of plants began probably when I was about 7. I'd already got really into nature before that. There was never really a point in my life where I wasn't really interested by the natural world. I think I strongly believe it's something that everyone is born with, and everyone sort of has, and unfortunately gets trained out of quite a lot of people these days. But yeah, so I sort of started with birds and beetles, believe it or not. Cool. My dad is really, really into birds and beetles. And we would go on bird watching trips, and we would spend long summer afternoons and evenings like in the fields behind our house with a sweep net, which my dad had made from like a load of random crap from the garage. So he'd got like this broomstick handle. And then what I suppose were a load of like coat hangers, which he twisted into this ring.
Yeah.
And then an old bed sheet, which formed like the bag of this net. And we'd go out into the field behind the house and like sweep it through the long grass, collect all these insects and invertebrates. And I'd put them all in little tubes and take them home and identify them, and then let them back into the garden again.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was so much fun. Just had such a great time. But it was only like a couple of years later that I really started noticing plants. Mm. And my mum knew what some of the commoner species were called. And so she very kindly answered all my questions about, you know, what's this, what's this, what's this? And yeah, kind of sort of, I don't really know what it was specifically about plants that grabbed me. I think at the time, actually, I was so like, you know, all I wanted was just to see everything and go chasing after everything. And so I'd be sprinting around the countryside, you know, running after birds and butterflies and dragonflies. And they would all just run away and fly away. And it really bummed me out. And, you know, all I wanted was
we
to
finally
give
them
some love
get
and appreciation.
It.
Yeah.
This is what it is. It's the fear of rejection.
Yeah, exactly. And plants, obviously... couldn't do that, and so they were forced to just sit there while I just looked at them for hours. So I think that was actually a major part of it.
Is it the lack of mobility in plants that you
they can't run away?
It certainly was part of it as a kid, yeah, because you know it was always so sad when I just wanted to you know, love this bird or this butterfly or whatever, and it would just disappear, and I'd just be left all by myself with, you know, with
you
just
know
the plants for company. So
I'm laughing, but it makes sense. Like, sorry, if you want to be interested in nature, go for something that's not mobile.
Exactly. It makes so much
Unless
sense.
Unless you like the chase.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. But you know there's a lot of chase involved as well, particularly if you're looking for rare things. There's a lot of hunting to be done.
Yeah,
so you
absolutely.
Still get that satisfaction of finding something.
You said there your mum was very good at identifying plants. Is this where because mm-hmm. you're good at that as well? I think so. Compared to me,
that's
and
very
Jan,
flattering.
Well, compared to me and Jan, you're going to be a level 20 expert. So what? How did you get so good at identifying plants? Was it following in your mum's footsteps?
Yeah. So yeah, my mum definitely gave me a good start. You know, she knew her buttercups from her dandelions, and so she was able to point out these things, or at least give me a starting point for like, you know, where to look in the book. But I think, to be honest, it's just a case of the years of repetition. You know, every single spring I go outside and I find the wood anemones and the bluebells and whatever. And yeah, over the years, I've just sort of collected all these names and things together. There have been times where I've put a bit more effort in. So when I was a kid, on like summer holidays, we'd go and stay in some like cottage and we'd like drive places to go for walks every day. And in the car on the way there, I'd be like scanning like the road verge, like, and listing off all the plants that I saw to the rest of my family. Which I think they probably got slightly annoyed with at times, but it's just a constant list of, oh, that's that and that's that. And then it got really nerdy when, so on the motorways, obviously, it was a lot harder for me to do that. And so I had like a spare wildflower guide, which I kept in the pocket in the seat in front of me. And I would just whip this out on the motorway and just start like learning the Latin names of the plants. This is me aged like 14, 15. Just like the nerdiest thing you could possibly do. But be like, guess what, you know, Esther and Naomi, my sisters, like, this plant's called this and this one's this. And they'd just be like, oh, shut up, Leif, there's too many Latin names. Go on, do something more normal, please.
That's quite a car game.
Well, it was for me. Yeah, I thought it was great. I won every single time. It was amazing.
I love that.
That's
going to
make
I
Spy
though.
So much harder.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it that you were just doing your own thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, just that was your interest and you went with it as far as you could.
Yeah, it's very much me in my comfort zone. And yeah, that's something I always recommend to people, is just try and ignore everyone saying you're weird, because it's not weird, it's just cool and they don't realize it.
Yeah. So, you know. That's good. Yeah, I like that.
So what tips have you got for people like Ryan and me to be able to identify plants? What would be a good way for us to do that?
So what I usually tell people is, if you want to start identifying plants, it can, you know, if you don't go about it in perhaps the right way, it can seem very overwhelming at the start, because there are just so many. And so my main bit of advice is always just to, like, firstly, stay local. Don't try and go off to some lovely nature reserve and, you know, get fully involved with all the plants initially, because there will just be so many that it could quite easily just be really overwhelming. So what I would say is just stick with, you know, your garden or, you know, your local green space, whatever it might be, even just the pavement outside, to be honest. There will be plants around and you'll have like a manageable number of species to just focus on initially. So when I do courses and things, I try and get people just to focus on like 10 species, learn 10 species, and that gives you just that first base to build off. And suddenly it becomes much less overwhelming if you know the first few, and then you can start building connections with like similar species. So yeah, that would be my advice, really. Just sort of take it easy, and don't put yourself straight in the deep end, as tempting as it is.
I like that as a tip, actually, because sometimes I think that you've hit that. I think with all natural science as well, it's so overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you actually scale it back and go, well, just go out on that green out there and see if you can find 10 different plants and then just learn about them.
Yeah.
I really like that as a method. It helps with my brain.
Yeah,
it does. It reduces it all down, yeah.
Are you going to do that, Jan?
I do like a book. I've lost it, but I used to have that encyclopedia. You know, the really fat one? The RHS one of the identifying plants, and I loved that book.
Yeah.
Used to sit there studying that way. Because there is, what Leif was saying, there is a satisfaction of even seeing a plant and thinking, oh, I know what that is. Like, I do get a bit of a thrill out of that when I have to keep quiet. No, I think I can't, look what Leif said, you can't go, that's one of those, you know, like, just. But I do.
That's why no one shares a car with Jan.
Yeah. Yeah. Too busy looking at the plants, not looking at the road.
Look at the road, Jan.
Yeah, that is a genuine problem. Roadside botanizing when you're driving is genuinely dangerous.
Botanizing, yeah, I like that word.
Yeah.
4% of road traffic accidents. Yeah. Are roadside botanizing.
All caused by me in a car, you know.
Yeah, just Leif, just localized traffic accidents with Leif. So you know, as we've clearly like found out now, you embrace life with plants and trees and other, you know, type of flora. But why, I guess, not to get too deep, but why is it important for you, and how do you believe that embracing plants and plants and other plants of nature can help people as well?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. I mean, for me, plants have always provided like a way to explore the world. So wherever I go, whether it's, you know, on a trip to a nature reserve, or, you know, a bike ride in the countryside, or just like walking to Tesco, I'm always scanning the ground for plants. I'm always using plants as a way of sort of getting around and like an excuse to get outside often. So throughout my life I've done that. They've also really helped me like develop a sense of place. So when I was growing up, I had this local hillside, this really small bit of downland on the hillside, which I went back to again and again and again, often, you know, two or three times a week. And I had a real sense of responsibility, and like, you know, this is my little patch to record the plants and the wildlife that's growing here. And you know, this is where I live, this is home, and these are the plants that define that for me. And even now, you know, I've moved away from there now, but whenever I find those plants in that habitat, it's always just such a wonderful reminder of home and those wonderful years growing up botanizing in the countryside. But I think there are just so many ways in which plants can help people and nature generally. You've got things, you know, obviously benefit to well-being and mental health is obviously a massive one. But you've also got slightly newer things which are coming out now, like, you know, social media. I know a load of people who are, you know, perhaps they live alone or find it harder to get outside, and actually using social media to engage with other botanists or other nature lovers is such a great way of just, you know, making friends and meeting people who share your interests. And you know, I could go on and on and on. So many different ways.
I think
ways.
This year, I think we kind of get the same answers with questions like this, because it's just this year, like you said, there's always slagging off social media, and I get it, right? I've watched The Social Dilemma on Netflix. I get the problem with social media. However, there are still ways to use it where you can really get a positive draw using social media in the way that it was meant to be used at the very base of its creativity. And I think nature is a perfect way with that. And I think saying to someone, just showing, look at the flower I found on the roadside, and someone appreciating that, is, I think nature's such an easy way to spread joy through social media.
Yeah.
As
completely
as that sounds.
Yeah. It's so true.
I do
though.
Think nature is good
so
for that.
True. Yeah, it is absolutely brilliant. And, you know, there are always cool things to photograph, and it's such an easy way of doing it, as you say.
So you said about home and going back to places, that place specifically. But also, when I was looking on your Instagram, you said about the oak tree that you go back to.
Oh, yes. My oak tree.
Yeah.
Oh.
wholesome thing.
Oh, no. So what is it that you love about this tree?
Oh, I miss my oak tree. It's just the most wonderful thing. I came across this oak tree when I was, it was back in 2009. I was out in the middle of the New Forest looking for marsh gentians, which are these wonderful deep blue flowers.
Oh, they're blue.
They're so cool. They're like cobalt blue. These are massive like trumpet flowers, and they've got the most incredible neon green spots. They're just mind-blowingly beautiful. It's hard to describe and do it justice. I was looking for them. They're quite rare. And so it's taken me quite a while to find them. And halfway through, I didn't give up. I was like, I need a break, because it's hard work walking around looking for plants. and so I sat myself down underneath this random tree. It was just an oak tree, which stood slightly out from the tree line behind it. And it's surrounded by this ring of bracken. And so it sort of feels slightly enclosed. But it's just got this lovely view in front of it out over the New Forest. And yeah, I literally just sat down to have some snacks. And 11 years later, I'm still going back literally just to sit underneath that tree. I spent hours just like hanging out, just, you know, watching all the wildlife, you know, watching nature do its thing around me. Whether that's, you know, beetles and stuff on the bark, crawling around on the bark, or, you know, robins singing from the branches. When the seasons change, obviously things like autumn, you've got acorns. I just absolutely love acorns. I think I end up posting so much on social media about my love for acorns because they're just great. My desk right now is just covered in acorns that I've collected from various walks. But yeah, it's just something about spending time with another individual of another species. You know, people like their friends, people say they're friends with their dogs and their cats. These individuals from another species that they spend a lot of time with. And I don't see why it should be any different just because it's a tree, a plant. Mm. It sounds slightly weird maybe to say that you're friends with a tree, but I will be the first person to admit that's absolutely fine. I would definitely say that I'm friends with this tree, or at least I think so. I can't ask the tree. So hopefully the oak tree, but yeah, this human's all right as well. But yeah,
also,
it's so
not
nice.
Mobile.
It can't run
exactly,
away.
Yeah, exactly.
So it can't run away from you.
Yeah.
Even if you're not up for this friendship, it's happening.
Yeah. It's spent the last 11 years desperately trying to run away. It's like, oh no, I can't get away from Leif.
Dropping acorns. It keeps going back.
Yeah, we exactly. need more acorns. Come on. wholesome to hear someone say that, though. I don't think I've ever heard anyone quite put into words as easily as that, as just to say it's just somewhere nice to go to be connecting with something. And the more I think about it, you know, I walk on Hampstead Heath 5 days a week with my job.
Yeah.
And there's areas that I love to go, but I don't think I'd thought about it for the reasons why I love those areas. And Jan, I'm sure you've got areas of nature around you where you're like, no, I tend to find myself going back to the same places. But no, I think it was so hot. When I saw you tweet and Instagram about it, I was like, oh, this is what... Follow the right people on social media. God damn. Get away from the Trump people and whatever on Brexit. Follow the tree-loving
people. The tree-loving people.
Right, we better get onto orchids. That's why we're here. That's why we're here. So, would it be right saying your main love is orchids?
I think there was definitely a point in my life where that would have been true. I think now wildflowers or plants generally would be the case. But yeah, there was certainly, but I don't know, my late teenage years, I would say particularly, orchids were the thing. They were just so cool, and they still are so cool. But yeah, I mean, there's something else really.
so what was it about them? Because obviously visually they're incredible. So what was it about, was that the main thing for you?
Yeah, certainly a big factor. I think, you know, without doubt, they're the most charismatic group of flowering plants that we have in this country. And I quite liked the, you know, there are 50 to 60 different species in this country. And that's just like, it felt like quite a nice number. I could like get to know them all really well. There were quite a lot, but not too many. And yeah, the diversity, even within the 50, 60 species that we have here, the floral diversity is just ridiculous. Like, you've got plants which are a few centimeters high and like tiny flowers, little green things, up to, you know, nearly a meter tall lizard orchids and helleborines, which just look completely different. You've got flowers which look like monkeys, like bees, like slippers, soldiers, pyramids. Like, it's just mind-blowing, the diversity in shape and color and form and things. So yeah, as a, you know, as a teenager, that just really grabbed my attention and completely captivated me. So yeah, it was mainly what they looked like, but also, you know, the rarity factor as well. We've got a lot of different rare species. So there's that thrill of finding something beautiful and rare. So yeah, those things I'd say mainly.
So how would I, because sometimes I'll get bought an orchid from a child in school, one of the supermarket orchids that you buy blue or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Your words, not mine.
Yeah, they look like supermarket orchids. They are.
No, they are. Yeah, some of them have been dyed. Yeah, the blue ones. Yeah.
They look like they've been.
Yeah, they put the dye in the water, and it gets put into the petals, so they go blue. But as soon as you take them home and start giving them normal water, they'll just go white.
Oh, so
my understanding.
How hard are they to keep? Like, because I've managed to keep one yet.
Well, okay, so I will preface my answer to this question by admitting that I have never properly owned an orchid. I was given one once, but it swiftly became apparent that I was absolutely no good at looking after it. And so I handed over custody to my mum, who actually kept it alive for many years. My answer to this question will be based on scientific intuition rather than personal experience.
Very well covered, Leif.
Yeah. Well, this is just so you know, if anyone follows my advice and ends up killing their orchid, then I've got this disclaimer, you know. they are traditionally, as I'm sure you're aware, very difficult to look after. Orchids are very, very fussy. They're very temperamental. I often describe them as the botanical equivalent of stroppy teenagers. Because as soon as something in their environment isn't quite right, they'll just go off in a huff and you won't see them for ages. They won't flower. Looking after them is difficult. And so people are always asking me, you know, oh, you like orchids? Like, how do I keep my orchid alive? And I always have to kind of say, well, I don't really know, I'm afraid. But what you could do is, my advice is basically work out what species you've got. Because, as I've said, they're very fussy. So each species has its own requirements. And so if you find out what it is, presumably that'll be on the label. I wouldn't really know, but I'm assuming it would be on the label. And then, Google the specific requirements for that particular species. But more general advice for looking after orchids would be, you know, in the wilds they grow 70% of the nearly 30,000 species of orchid in the world. Grow on, yeah. Yeah,
there's 30,000 in the world.
Yeah, yeah. So people always think, you know, orchids are really rare, because, you know, a lot of them are. But actually, in terms of species diversity, they are the largest or the second largest family of flowering plants in the world.
Oh, 30,000. Jesus. Yeah. I didn't know it was going to be that. When you said 53 in the UK, I thought, oh, maybe it's a few hundred globally. 30,000.
Yeah, there's a couple in the rainforest.
See, I don't think of them as being a British plant. They don't look like a British native plant, do they?
They don't at all, do they?
They look really exotic. And
yeah, people are always so surprised when they tell them we've got not just one orchid, but more than 50 different species growing wilds in
this
country.
Was a lot.
There was something on Gardener's World about it, which is a few weeks ago.
Here she goes.
Where they showed you the monkey ones. And it was somewhere in Kent.
Yeah, yeah. Ah, yes, I remember. I was shown that as well, yeah.
Yeah, it was quite good. And I was really amazed, you know, like the one that I saw it on your Instagram that looks like a little person.
Yeah.
The arms, legs, and there was one that was the monkey face one.
Yeah, that was John Dunn on Gardener's World, is that right?
Probably, I can't remember his name.
Probably, yeah. No, I remember that being very good.
So interesting.
Yeah, they're remarkable. But yeah, so 70% of those 30,000 odd species live in tropical regions, and like they grow on trees, so they don't sit in the soil like all of our native species here. They wrap themselves around the branches or the trunks of trees, and they basically like take all the nutrients they need from the like sort of humus which builds up on these branches, and they take their moisture from the air. And so obviously a lot of these tropical forests are in like, they're up in the cloud layer. And so what these orchids are used to is like moisture, like high humidity in the air and moisture in the air. And so the other thing I'd tell people when they ask me how to look after their orchid is basically don't water it with like a watering can or a glass of water, because that will probably rot the roots. What you want to do is you want to get like one of those mister things and just spray to kind of like emulate a cloud, basically spray the water on. But yeah, I think generally just put it on a sunny windowsill and basically ignore it. You know, if it likes it, it likes it. If it doesn't, you'll know very quickly and you can move it.
Yeah. The more I hear about plants, the more I hear that's the case.
Yeah.
Yeah, leave it alone.
Just leave it alone.
Yeah.
Just water it once in 3 weeks, carefully, and go from there.
Yeah.
Obviously, orchids are, as we've just found out, so unique from not just, you know, how they live, but also, you know, in coloration and shape as well, which is incredible. But what actually makes an orchid? What makes it separate from other plant species other than DNA?
That is a good question. There's no one absolute thing which unites them all that nothing else has. But I would say there are three things which kind of together define the orchid family. So the first thing is that the male and female parts in the flower, in most flowers around the world in different species, the male and female parts are separate. Whether that's in the same flower or in different flowers, they're always separate structures, the stamen and the stigma. But in orchids, those things have been fused into one structure, which is called the column. I think there's maybe one other family of flowering plants that does that, but it's very small. So it can't be used as only the orchids do this. But that's one thing. The other main thing is their seeds are absolutely minuscule. They're like specks of dust. And this is because a large part of seeds is called the endosperm, and the endosperm is basically like a packed lunch. So most plants will send out their seeds out into the world with this packed lunch of sugars and starches, which helps it, you know, keep it alive when it's in the soil. So it germinates. It doesn't have any leaves or anything, so it needs this endosperm of sugars to keep it alive until it produces its own leaves. And then obviously it can photosynthesize and stuff by itself. Now, the orchids, they're pretty mean, really, because they send off their little baby orchids into the world with absolutely no packed lunch whatsoever, which just seems really mean. But the reason that orchids can survive, despite the fact they've got no packed lunch, is because they're really, really good at making friends. And so what they do is when the little baby orchid seed lands in the soil, it immediately makes friends with a fungus, which I think is incredibly entertaining. So they've arrived in the soil and they've made their fungus friend, and they're like, look, you know, my mum didn't give me a packed lunch. Can I share some of your packed lunch? Yeah.
Can I have that cheese string?
Yeah, exactly. Can I have a cheese string? And so the fungus is like, yeah, sure, no worries. And they like team up and they form this relationship, which is called a mycorrhizae. And during the early few weeks, months of the orchid's life, it is completely dependent on nutrients from the fungus. Now, a lot of species will then sort of wean themselves off the fungus during their lives as you know, they start photosynthesizing and producing sugars and stuff themselves. But some species will just remain completely dependent on the fungus for their entire life.
I've had friends like that.
Yeah. What was your question? Oh yeah, what makes an orchid orchid? So yeah, it's completely derailed. The male and female structures fused into a column, and then the fact that the seeds don't have this packed lunch, this endosperm, and they have to form this relationship with the fungus. So I'd say amazing. Those three things together make an orchid.
God, that's so that is- like That's incredible. I find that really amazing.
It's insane. Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yeah, and it's just another thing which makes orchids incredibly cool. Mm. There's an endless list of things.
And the way you explain it, it makes it understandable, because it's not, about the packed lunch and the making friends. I get that now.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you think so.
That's why we do this show.
I know. Do you know what? I've got a question to ask you.
Go
for
it.
If you don't mind, about your book, which I am going to read, because it actually looks like my sort of thing. But when you went off to do this orchid hunting...
Yeah.
You just finished school, so how old were you then?
Yeah, so I was 19. It was my gap year.
And you just went off in an old car too?
I did, yeah. Started in one car, which then broke down, so I had to get another one. it was a series of cars.
Wow.
I spent a summer from May to September before going off to uni just... going out to look for orchids. It was enormous fun.
So you didn't go home in that time?
Oh, no, I did, yes.
Oh, you
no,
did?
I
did. Oh, cause I did. My question what did your mum say? That was.
Oh, I see. No, there was a lot of, like, camping around the country because, there are orchids up in Scotland that I couldn't see anywhere else. There was a lot of camping around the country as well, but I did spend a lot of time at home.
Right, so, Leif, we know that orchids are... a good looking plant, pretty.
Yeah. Yes.
But have they got a part to play, in our ecosystem?
Yeah, no, they absolutely do. For various reasons. You've got species which form sort of these very specific relationships with certain insects. And often you'll get species which are only pollinated by individual insect species. And perhaps the most famous example of that is an orchid named after none other than Charles Darwin himself. Because he came across this orchid in Madagascar. And it's got this great big long tube called a spur, which sticks out the back of the flower. It's really, really narrow, and it's about 30, 40 centimetres long. So it's really, really long tube. And right at the tip, you've got like a little pool of nectar. And Darwin saw this plant and was like, quite obviously, in my mind, there is an insect out there who has a really, really, really long tongue. And their tongue is this length, and it'll get down to the bottom and get that nectar. And everyone else was like, no way, obviously that doesn't exist. Like, insect. Yeah, it's a stupid thing to say. But what was incredible is that 21 years after Darwin's death, they discovered this moth, which has this tongue, which is the exact length of this orchid spur. And sure enough, it pollinates this orchid. And so I'm not... entirely sure whether it's got any other flowers that it pollinates, but I'd be surprised. There are lots of orchids who, they support individual insect species. But more generally, orchids are just a really, really good indicator of like a healthy functioning ecosystem.
Yeah.
Like I said before, they're very fussy. And so as soon as you get... a little bit of disturbance in the habitat or something's not quite right, then the orchids are like the first thing to go. So if you find orchids in a habitat, you know that it's functioning well, it's performing its ecosystem services, and it's, just a healthy place for wildlife. I'd say that was a pretty big role that they play.
Yeah, absolutely. And you might have touched on it there about the shape, because we've said a couple of times throughout this show that orchids are known for having awesomely bizarre plant shapes, from things that look like little people to monkeys to like a lot more than me, but is that role purely an attraction for pollinators, or is there a reason for these funky shapes?
In some cases it's just humans finding patterns, so the ones which look like little people, we think it's just they just happen to look like little people, but yeah. There are a group of orchids which are collectively known as bee orchids. And the bee orchid, one of them is just called the bee orchid, and that's my favourite plant of all time. And it's actually what got me into orchids in the first place, because the pollination mechanism for these plants is just the best thing ever. Because so we have four species here in the UK, which are called the bee orchid, the fly orchid, the late spider orchid, and the early spider orchid. Mm. And they have evolved to exploit the sexual desire of male insects. Quite a silence there.
Just, you said that and then looked at me and Jan and went, strap yourself in.
So basically, like, with the insects that pollinate these species, there's this period of time in the spring where there are males around but no females. The males hatch earlier than the females. So, you know, this period of time differs in length between different species, but it generally can be like a week long. So these orchids have timed their flowering periods to coincide with this period of time where there are male bees, say, flying around, but no female bees. Now, it's the male bee, the flower of one of these orchids, looks, smells, and feels exactly like a virgin female bee, which in itself is just extraordinary. So the early spider orchid, for example, I remember reading a research paper where they'd collected the scent emitted by an early spider orchid flower, and they'd collected the scent emitted by the virgin female of the species which pollinates it, and they'd analysed all the chemical compounds in the scent, and there are like 220 something compounds, and they just like perfectly match up between these two things, which is just remarkable. Wow. I can never get over how insane that is. So to the male bee, this is just a female. So obviously when the males come out in the spring, they are like genetically programmed to do one thing and one thing only, and that's find a mate and pass on their genes to the next generation. And so our male bee is flying around looking for a female, but of course there aren't any. And he comes across a population of these orchids, and he sees at least what he perceives to be a female resting on the flower with her head buried amongst the petals. And he thinks, great, this is my lucky day. I've scored. Best day ever. And he flies down.
Throws his kebab down on the floor. Yeah.
I love that image. He flies down, he lands on the petal, and still completely convinced that this is a female, he actually starts mating with the flower. Now, the orchid, obviously, while the bee is completely distracted, having a great time, the orchid sort of slowly lowers these two like sacks of pollen and deposits them on the back of the bee's neck. And they just sort of stick to the back of the neck. The bee is completely oblivious. Has no idea what's going on. You know, as far as he's aware, he's on cloud nine, having an amazing time. Now, after a while, as you might imagine, the bee starts getting a bit frustrated by the lack of reciprocity, lack of action. And so he
lack
buzzes
of appreciation.
Off in search. he buzzes off in search of a more enthusiastic partner. And so he's flying around again. He's like, okay, this time I'm going to find like a real female. He comes across another population of the orchids, immediately falls for the ruse all over again. Attempting to mate with this next flower. Yeah, I know. You'd think they'd work it out.
Learn, mate. Learn. You're getting yourself in toxic relationships.
And in doing so, he pollinates the orchid, and it's just this incredibly clever, ingenious mechanism. And my favourite thing about it is this entire fraud is masterminded by a plant, and I just love it when the plants get one over on the animals. It never seems to happen, but when it does, it's so good.
That it went on a journey.
I always go off on one when I get asked.
No,
about
it's amazing.
Not
that
you ask about
nature
them, but
works like that.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah,
brilliant.
So cool.
Brilliant story.
It's so detailed and so specific and so niche.
Yeah, it really is.
It must have taken such a journey to get to that stage.
Because, yeah.
Like you said, even matching those 200 plus compounds, that would take scientists ages to try and do that.
Yeah,
so for
agreed.
Nature just to go, we've done it.
Yeah,
taken
millions of years, but yeah, you're right. But what's interesting is that so the bee orchid specifically has actually abandoned this mechanism, so it's quite obviously evolved the same process as all the others. But
yeah.
It's thought that maybe the specific insect which pollinated it, it might have died out, become extinct, or perhaps it moved on to a different orchid species, and so the bee orchid has had to make this drastic lifestyle change, and it now pollinates itself, and it's doing incredibly well. It's very widespread around Britain, particularly in England, and it's relatively common. What is slightly worrying is because it's self-pollinating, that's genetically non-ideal, and so while it's doing fine now, with climate change or any change to the environment, it might not be able to handle it very well. And so, if the climate keeps warming at the rate it's currently warming at, we could see some real problems for bee orchids.
And is that because it becomes too specific to one type, if that makes
sense?
Do you know what I mean? It's, like you said, self-pollinating. It was almost like it's just that one... I don't know what I'm trying to say.
It means there's there's a lack of variation in the genes. There are no new genes coming in, no new genetic information. So they have much less of a armory to deal with any change in the environment. It is slightly concerning. But climate change is also affecting the early spider orchid, which still has its pollinator species. But the problem is that as the climate warms, I think the orchid is flowering earlier and earlier and earlier, but the bee isn't emerging as early.
Gotcha.
If that makes sense. And so while there is still an overlap, at some point they're going to not overlap at all.
Yeah.
And at that point, the early spider orchid is not going to do well. There are little things like that, little effects of climate change, which, most people, never hear about. And there'll be so many things, obviously, around the world that we never even know exist.
Absolutely. It's a scary thought.
Yeah.
It is.
It's so detailed. So detailed and so minute, but so it got such a big impact.
Yeah.
Jan, do you want to ask our last question on Into the Foliage?
Yeah, so Leif, if you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone regarding the natural world, what would it be?
That's such a good question. I think for me, I would always recommend people to find opportunities to talk to people about nature, whether that's, a stranger who's found you with your bum sticking out of a bush looking at something cool, or a friend who's asked what you did at the weekend and you went bird watching or whatever. I know it can be very scary, particularly when it's a friend, but use those opportunities to tell people, just how extraordinary nature is. Basically just practice what you preach, get out into nature, spend time with it, and never, ever, ever stop telling everyone how amazing it is. Because if people don't know, then they're not going to care about it. So
I think that's a great bit of advice.
Keep telling people.
That's one I don't think we've had on even Into the Wild, is just talk about it. I really like that. That's a really cool way to end.
Nice.
Leif, thank you so much for being on our first proper episode of Into the Foliage.
It's been
amazing to talk to you.
Thank you
for having me.
And I think we're both looking forward to reading your book.
nice. Well, I hope you enjoy it if you do get around to reading it.
Yeah, I will.
For the listeners, although we will be a month ahead, we're currently, as recording, about to go into lockdown. So we've got perfect amount of time, Leif, to
read
your wonderful book.
Boris has given you a good chunk of time for reading the orchid entry. Yeah, nice.
But thank you so much. And from myself and Jan, we wish you all the best in the next coming challenging month. And
thank you
for
very
the rest
much.
Of the year.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been amazing.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work Leif is working on, you can do so on Instagram and Twitter at Leif Burzweden. Don't forget you can get in touch with me and Jan at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let us know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.